okay, we open on a Air Force base. There's a demonic general who's saying they're going to bomb Tokyo, firebomb Tokyo next week. Muldrow is a tail gunner in a B-29. He modifies his gear. A shrimp and a big guy come up to him. They challenge him to a pull-up contest. He wins the pull-up contest, takes the shrimp under his wing, teaches him how to make fire with a flint. Then they take off in a B-29 towards Tokyo. Muldrow shoots down a plane on the way in the darkness. They get to Tokyo. It's covered in balloons. They're dropping bombs on it. Their plane explodes. Muldrow grabs a parachute and jumps out the door. He's flying through the air. And then we cut to a flashback in Alaska. He's taking a dog sled through the snow. And then the dog sled breaks. It's broken. Dog sled can't go any further.
Wow. 5 seconds to spare. It's incredible. Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Welcome to Dunk Square. Dunkunstall is the gallery. Dunk Square is the neighborhood. We're like Dime Square, but we're communist. And this is To the White Sea.
Oh wait, yeah. Did you just say that yet?
I wasn't.
Do
wasn't
you want to introduce the guest?
The guest is you. Yeah, yeah. And we have Austin Purnell here. He's our he was an amazing actor. He played Red, and today he's our George Clooney in a Roman centurion costume.
We're here. We're in Dunkunsthal. Everyone came out. We just watched the scenes. Everyone has scripts. Everyone has sandwiches. We have tea sandwiches and coffee. And we're going to, every week we've been doing a transition where, like, Ben said, let's get weird. Yeah. And then Emily said, enter the void.
Should we get one from the audience?
I think we should get one from the audience.
All right. Anybody have an idea for a transition?
Yes. Teamwork.
Wait, grab a mic.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
That's perfect.
That's right. Well, this is episode 10.
Pages 19 and 20.
The dogs on the right have come loose from the sled itself and are now connected by harness only to their partners on the left. The severed trace means the team no longer pulls. Muldrow steps from behind the sled to examine the harness. The rawhide strap that connected the right rearmost dog to the sled has a frayed end hanging free. The dogs, unsure of why they are halted and restive, look back at Muldrow. He steps back to the sled. He takes off his mittens to undo the lacing that holds a canvas cover on the sled. He rests the mittens on the front of the sled. The lacing is tight. Muldrow pauses in undoing the knot to clap his hands together. The dogs start at the sharp noise, then resettle. Muldrow blows on his hands, hurriedly finishes undoing the knot. He pulls back a corner of the canvas and pulls out a length of line. He goes to the snapped rawhide, blowing on his hands. He hurriedly and expertly ties one end of the line to one end of the snapped trace. He takes a knife from a sheath at his waist and cuts off about a foot of line. After resheathing the knife, he pauses to slap his hands down against his thighs. He waves his hands vigorously, rubs them briskly together. He looks at the horizon. The sun hangs just above the horizon. He picks up the length of line and is about to start tying it, a little more fumbling now, to the other loose end of the severed trace. Before the knot is finished, the line is whipped out of his hands. There is snarling and yapping. The two dogs in the middle of the team have started fighting. Their motion has jerked the line from Muldrow's hands and given the sled an unbalanced lurch forward. A third dog, constrained by the harness, starts snarling and awkwardly twists to join in the fight. Muldrow grabs a whip from its mount on the back of the sled. He wades into the yapping dogs and uses the knout to slap them apart and restore order. A couple of lingering snarls, a couple more blows from the knout. The team is now quiet. Muldrow blows on his hands, rubs them together. He glances across the snow. The bottommost sliver of the sun is just disappearing below the horizon. He replaces the whip and goes to the front of the sled, blowing on his fists to pick up his mittens. The mittens are gone. He looks at the churned snow in front of the sled, but the mittens are not there. In lurching forward, the sled probably covered them. Muldrow shakes his head, angry. He slaps his hands against his thighs. He goes to the back of the sled. With clicks and shouts, he mushes the team. With the unbalanced team pulling and Muldrow awkwardly wrestling the sled from behind, he finally manages to clear the sled from the area it had formerly covered. There is churned snow. No foreign objects break the field of white. He blows on his hands, then stabs them into the snow here and there, feeling. He comes up empty. Aloud, oh, as he slaps his stinging hands together, he glances at the horizon. The horizon now bisects the setting sun. It will soon have disappeared entirely. Muldrow looks at the team of dogs. Dogs here and there, still restive and curious at this lengthening halt, look back, ears pricked. Muldrow trots to where He was working on the line. He stoops and with difficulty picks up the two separate ends. His fingers are barely working sufficiently to pick up each end of the line. He clamps them awkwardly between middle of thumb and ball of opposing finger. His fingertips will not cooperate in forming a knot. He vigorously thumps his hands. Tries again.
To the white sea. To the white sea. Of all the things I'd like to see, to the white sea is the one I cannot.
Is everybody able to follow that?
I like that you and I think both came out of the gate with a lot of energy.
Yeah. Well, I had a teleprompter, so I was like trying to fit it all in.
I think our energy matches the panic that he's in at this moment.
Well, he lost his gloves.
When everything's falling apart.
Yeah.
I mean, it's bad stuff.
Yeah.
Our previous guest, Ben Brewer, said he thought these were the best two pages of screenplay writing he had ever read.
Wow.
His entire life, just because of the kind of nightmare way that one thing leads to another thing, and all of a sudden he's in such danger so fast.
Yeah. And yet we're in the past.
And yet we're in the past.
But we're so present. Does the public have any thoughts on any thoughts on what we just experienced?
It's not
what?
Well, we're all the same here, right? Isn't that the idea?
Well, I'm in the public.
So we're all part of the
we're
public.
We're all part of the public.
Okay, so we're all part of the public.
Yeah.
Does anyone have a first reaction just to those two pages?
Hi, I'm Eva.
Hi, Eva.
Hi.
Hi. I saw Bo is Afraid last night.
Nice.
And I feel like the sort of horrifying moment of something slipping out of grasp and becoming a disaster. And it's like prolonged, and then it's just, you know, in a way it's like banal, right? But it's also life-threatening, both.
Right. It's kind of like the... It's kind of like the scraper in Fargo when he can't scrape his windshield.
He's like, and he has a meltdown. He throws a tantrum.
It's a meltdown. But yeah. I'm always thinking about his fingers. You know, like how he could get frozen.
William H. Macy.
Yeah.
Well, for all those characters are in danger of getting frostbite basically the entire film.
Yeah. But I really like what you're saying about the banality of it. There's something about this that you could relate to, despite the fact that it's like the 40s and like. A guy in the middle of Alaska, there's like, you suddenly, like, you totally sympathize with him.
If you've lost your keys and realized you're locked out of your house. Yeah. And your phone's dead.
Totally.
Yeah. There's two ice scraper scenes in Fargo. There's when he's burying the thing, Steve Buscemi's burying the thing, and then there's when William H. Macy has the freak out. Who's got the colder fingers?
I think definitely Buscemi's got the colder fingers
because
he doesn't have gloves on in that scene.
Yeah, he's also having a meltdown.
Yeah.
Both of them, it's like meltdown scenes. No one uses a window scraper without freaking out in that movie.
Do we see a meltdown on, just based on what we've read, did we see Muldrow freak out, like on his face?
Well, it's more like his
actions, right?
He screamed, right?
He says,
he slaps his stinging hands together. That seems like involuntary. Like pain, which is kind of a first for this guy.
That's a meltdown. Yeah.
Yeah. He's screaming. He's out in the middle of nowhere. He's screaming.
This is like Alcoholics Anonymous, but for Coen Brothers fans. So
I'm a everybody. I'm a Coen's head.
Yeah. My name's Cole. I'm a Coen's head. Like I watched True Grit last night. I had other things to do, but I watched True Grit.
Hell yeah.
You guys are like, it's okay. We've all been there.
Yeah.
I am reading No Country for Old Men for the first time, the book, and I ordered To the White Sea, the book, and I couldn't find it at any bookstore, so I ordered it on Amazon, and it hasn't come yet. There were only a couple copies left, and to scratch the itch of, I went out and bought No Country at a bookstore, because I won't say anything past these pages, but I did. I discovered the podcast. I was like, wow, this is crazy that this script exists. And I read it like pretty much immediately. And I was like just struck by what I feel like are kind of the similarities to No Country. Reading it right now, though, like, and now that I'm reading the No Country for Old Men book, the way that these two pages are written is so much like reading two pages of No Country for Old Men.
The book or the screenplay?
The book. Okay, I actually have not read the No Country for Old Men screenplay, I don't think. So much of that book is like, as with the movie, it's like Llewellyn, like, you know, setting, like, you know, climbing up an embankment and catching his boot on something and bending over and all this process and yeah. with the temples and stuff. And this reads just so much like the way that that book is written. I'm looking forward to reading To the White Sea, the James Dickey book. So yeah, that's all I have to say about that. It's just like, I'm just struck by how much they must like that type of kind of sparse prose, writing about just doing things with your hands under pressure. And kind of, you don't really know exactly, like when Llewellyn goes to get the poles, you're like, what is he going to do with the poles? And that's the suspense. You're like, this guy has a plan. And this Muldrow character is similar. It's like, in a sense, you're, it's like, why, what's the, what's, how is this going to get worse that he doesn't, why are mittens essential to what he has to do next? And like, it seems like he's fucked that he doesn't have his mittens. And like, you want to know why, like, it can't just be that his hands are.
Oh, he'll get frostbite cold. In about 5 seconds out there.
Yeah, I guess it is. I guess they are like in the Yukon, but it's just that suspense of like, this guy kind of understands the situation better than I ever could. Yeah. And yeah. It's not going well.
And I'm certainly very curious, like, what he's going to do. Like, I mean, so one thing I should say for anybody who hasn't heard the show is that I haven't read the script and Ray has. And like, part of that is just sort of being able to try to anticipate like, where it might be going. And like, my first thing is thinking about like at beginning of Empire Strikes Back, where he like would maybe slice open one of those dogs and put his hands in the dog's belly. I would imagine that that might be on the table, on the ice table. David, you look like you want to say something.
Yeah. I mean, as you were saying that about the No Country for Old Men, I was thinking the same thing, and the word like highbrow MacGyver popped to mind. Like highbrow MacGyver, like investing ordinary objects with all of this sort of like amazing dramatic potential. The other thing that stuck out to me was the dogs are like both another character, but not. They're somewhere between a character and not, and it's more interesting than if he was alone. And it reminded me of all these sort of characters, sort of like Donnie or Marge Gunderson's second in command, who are like funny and don't quite have the interiority or the ability to solve problems and have agency in the story. They're just sort of there to witness it and make it more funny and more effed up.
It's interesting.
So I think there's like a connection between the dogs and Donnie and all these sort of like cartoonish non-characters that pop up in the Coen brothers.
Yeah. Let's hold that thought, actually. I think that we're gonna pick that up again.
The dogs are there, like, you know, because they're a huge part of the dilemma that's going on, but they're also like great reaction shots, basically, because they're also like perfect comic timing, like even in the super tense sequence.
Yeah, you need a funny, goofy, not very smart person, in this case a dog, just to witness, and it makes everything funnier and heightens it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan of saying that like a setting or a city is a character in and of itself, but I think for like animals or anything with like emotions and a face, like you could definitely call that a character for sure.
I feel like in Coen Brother films in general, I mean, at some point we have to do the animals episode, because those like the horse in True Grit is a full character. The cat in Llewyn Davis is like a full character.
Yeah.
There's other stuff like that, right?
Oh, definitely. There's so many four-legged
friends.
One more
animal. There was a bear that was cut from Miller's Crossing. Yeah. We discussed that. Yeah.
There's all the dogs in the chase scene from
Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Babe the Blue Ox.
Babe the Blue Ox. Very solid. Yeah. Thank you, Jeff. Yeah.
There was a lot of dog stuff cut from the Hail Caesar script, I noticed.
What do you mean?
The pages, the dog is like, that doesn't happen. Am I crazy?
Should we table that for?
Yeah,
we
let's save it.
We can get back to that.
We'll save it. Yeah, no, I'm curious about that. Yeah,
that's excellent.
For sure. Put a pin in that.
Do you want to talk about how the dog's like kind of having a meltdown affects him? It's like, is that because they start to fight. At some point, they fight, and that really makes things worse.
Right? Yeah, well, it's like he's somebody who can control them when they're like a team. Like he's like a he's when they're like connected to this sort of physical phalanx, basically, he knows what's going on. But something happened with his gear and they all became individuals, and suddenly he's not able to form a union.
Can we just talk about what goes wrong, how it cascades, how he tries to fix it, and then where he gets stuck? The first thing is that the thing comes to a halt.
Yeah.
The harness is broken.
Yeah.
Then he does a classic thing where he like repurposes another part of the thing, cuts it off, and starts to use that as like the Band-Aid, right?
Yeah. And he takes his mittens off because he needs like fine motor control.
Okay. So that's the problem. But then
he takes off his mittens. He rests the mittens on the front of the sled. Was that the problem? In the lurching forward, the sled. Oh, yeah.
It says right after he rested the mittens down, it says in lurching forward, the sled probably covered them. So that's sort of the screenplay is sort of supposing that's what happened. I don't know how that's represented visually.
You got to put your mittens in your pocket.
Yeah. He learned a lesson that day.
Why can't it just be klutziness? Like that's such a hallmark of Coen Brothers. And like we just both dropped our scripts, like trying to.
Yeah.
Exchange the mic.
This guy has been ice cold though so far.
Yeah. There's bozos and then there's like sort of like
stoics.
Stoics, yeah. And sometimes there's stoic bozos for sure.
Which one's the stoic bozo?
You put me on the spot. I got to think.
I'm really
about
interested.
It. Let's put a pin in it.
Well, is Mannix?
Well, isn't Llewellyn in New Country for Old Men?
Stoic bozo.
Like this, he's great. Good at everything.
And perfect job.
Early
yeah.
when he's
yeah.
hunting, Llewellyn's good at everything. He's you know, he's a highbrow MacGyver character for us to watch and observe how he knows, you know, how a bullet, you know, loses its altitude, you know, every 100 yards it travels, you know, real competent dude. But by the end of the story, he's revealed to be just another fucking chump who makes dumb decisions with a woman and for money
he
and just, you know, venal and stupid like the rest of us.
Yeah, he's a bozo.
He's a simple guy.
Yeah.
Not like a complex, kind of like the what's it, Billy Bob in Man Who Wasn't There. It's like a guy trying to do something kind of scheming, and it just being a little too complex for him to keep up with once he sets it in motion.
Yeah,
I guess we'll see if he is. We'll see. I suppose I haven't read this. If Muldrow is dumb, or if he fucks up, or if he's just going to be awesome the whole way through, like in a normal movie, or if he'll be, you know, kind of conesy and kind of drop the ball somewhere. I don't know.
Yeah, no. I mean, I thought there would never be a flashback, and we're in the middle of a flashback. So who knows? Maybe he'll die and there will be like a change of POV.
I wondered too whether this was like a foreshadowing of things we've already seen or things to come. I think we've been talking about like tragedy kind of happening as a whimper, life ending as a whimper. And I just think that's like a through line in quite a few of these movies. That was my thing. Also, I like this image of the dogs as the team. And sort of like, I guess we'll get back to that. We pin that.
Let's talk about it. This is such a solitary and visual movie, and the Coens are people who have great shapes and colors and sounds and shots. They also have great character dynamics and dialogue. So, you know, I think especially moving forward as we get into the like what I've been told or what I presume is like a more dialogue-free, solitary section of the script, we're gonna have to get a little abstract with like the prisms, you know, like the way that we structure these episodes, you know. So I saw the word team, thought about us all getting together, and I was like, teamwork.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. Yeah, because it really is, everything is okay until the point when the dogs start to fight. And I really do think that that's what throws off Muldrow's plan. Like he's in control to fix it, but then the dog's pettiness is what actually, you know, pulls the thing forward, and that's when he loses his mittens.
There's sort of a theme of like smart guy trying to organize dumb guys, which you see a lot in Miller's Crossing. right?
For sure.
All the normal gangsters are kind of like doges in the sense that they're just running around. And Eddie Mannix in Hail Caesar, he's sort of like trying to like bring order to a bunch of knuckleheads.
Although John Polito is definitely like, John Polito is a bozo, and like the Dane, his like right-hand man, is kind of the sort of person who tries to bring order. So sometimes it's like the lieutenant is the one who's like has to hold it down.
Well, what do you guys think is going to happen next? Do you think anyone have a feeling of what's around the corner in this moment of extreme tension?
I think it's going to get worse.
Yeah.
There's this like theme of like a man versus nature going on, obviously like a dude in a snow trying to control some dogs, but like, I don't know, there are all these like man-made objects that he's relying on to survive in the situation, the mittens, the like harness. And once those are gone, he's kind of like out of control, like not able to control his like environment. So I think like, I don't know, there's this like off balance tension with the like harness being broken, and then suddenly the dogs aren't like working. And then once you lose your mittens, suddenly mittens aren't working. So I don't know, I think he's just going to get really cold.
It's going to get really cold.
We're on page 20, so.
We're on page 20.
Yeah.
Page 20 of 89 pages. So we're getting close to the end of the first act. Yeah.
Should we jump into today's discussion?
I love, basically every week, you know, me and Jordan trade off. One of us is the presenter of the presentation. And I love weeks when Jordan is the presenter, like weeks like this. So I'm so excited to hear Jordan explain why you chose this week Teamwork as the prism.
Yeah, I mean, the Coens are great writers of, you know, a lot of times it's like one person, and a lot of times it's two people, I will say. Like watching some of these, some of their movies or kind of scrubbing through them, like really seems to be a lot of scenes of like two people working things out.
Yeah.
I wonder why.
Yeah.
Coens. Two people working, but some of my ground rules for this was I wanted to have three or more characters, and some things we can think about when we're watching these scenes is like, what's going on, who are the characters and how are they different, what are they doing, like what's their like physical action, what were the other bullet points I gave you, Ray?
Like how do they show up for each other, how do they come apart, how do they come together.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what do they accomplish or not accomplish?
Yeah. Yeah, do you want to just recap the scene?
Yeah,
quickly?
The scene where George Clooney wakes up, and he finds himself in a place he's never been. He walks into this room full of men, all men, and they're talking about, and he says, like, they're like, what's going on? And he says, yeah, what's going on? And they're like, well, we're reading the minutes. You missed the minutes. And then they give him finger sandwiches, and they explain to him that they're studying economics and history. And it's sort of like a big ping pong, you know, like a 10-player ping pong game where people are trying to explain to him like how society works or how society functions. And they're basically trying to explain communism to him without saying that they're communists. And then like the big sort of reveal is the voiceover comes in at the end and says, and so Baird Whitlock found himself in the company of communists.
And these are the kind of meetings that people got blacklisted for, right? This is like exactly the kind of book clubs that then just like had like just like completely outsized, destroyed people's careers.
Absolutely.
Just for being on, yeah.
For having these meetings.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, growing up when you read about like the you know, HUAC stuff, the sort of the line was always like, well, they weren't really communists, you know, but
they were just guys with jobs like working for Hollywood studios.
Yeah.
That were like blowing off steam by talking about this stuff.
Yeah.
Pooling their money.
But I think maybe it's cooler if they were.
If they were what?
If they were communists and really were trying to organize. A lot of this probably led to some of the strikes that are happening right now that, you know, that happened back then and happen right now. I mean, right.
What year was Hail Caesar made?
2016.
2016, yeah.
Who's that? Who's the actor of what? Girls fame, the photographer.
Karpovsky,
yeah.
With his fantastic timing, popping the
the
bulb.
Yeah, JT, feel free to just blind us. Just like we're all going to get blacklisted by like being here.
I mean, it's all character actors.
Should we plan some kind of like a bombing or something though, like while we're here?
Do what?
Should we like plan some kind of like terrorism while we're here?
Yeah, let's do that on mic.
On mic.
I think it's a great idea. Yeah. No, I mean like, okay, so I was just saying.
Someone is tapping in right now because you just said that.
It's like a rogues gallery of character actors from like all different eras and all different places.
Yeah.
Like the fact that they cut to the guy from the Mulholland Drive like diner meltdown scene, Patrick Fischler.
Yeah.
At a certain point just feels like they withhold the fact that you don't see him until that point, and it's just like, oh my god, and like Melamed's here, Fischler's here, Krumholz is here.
He's here too.
Fisher Stevens, you know. Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible collection of people.
Jeffrey Donovan from Burn Notice.
Is that true?
The guy from Burn Notice and Sicario.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Donovan.
I believe that's his name.
Wow.
Oh, cutie on the left.
Yeah, he's a handsome man, I'd say. But yeah, it's a real rabble. Like it doesn't seem like a bunch of smart people. They seem they seem smart in some ways, but some of them are these weird goons and they're all arguing. They have different opinions. They're kind of like those dogs, you know, all going in different directions.
Thanks, John. That's what I should have said. Yeah.
So the dynamic is one character and then a bunch of characters that are the same that are all so you're saying like it's like Muldrow is to Clooney as the dogs are to the screenwriters.
But the guys are they're matched somehow. They're all dogs or they're all communists or in a Hudsucker Proxy they're all boardroom executives, but they're all piping up with their different wise ideas, and sometimes they kind of bicker with one another, and it must be what it's like to be the Coen brothers dealing with a whole bunch of eccentric personalities or just how they think humanity is. I don't know.
This must have been an interesting scene to direct, for sure.
I think that some filmmakers, you know, they have their main characters and they develop them a lot, and then they have their lesser characters and they just sort of phone it in. But I think the Coen brothers do a really good job of deliberately making these secondary characters into cartoons, like really using the language of cartooning. To be like, we don't have the time. This person says two things. So we're just going to find this guy with the perfectly weird face. And that's going to tell the story, you know?
Yeah. I think it was Emily in episode 7 was talking about how their storyboards look like cartoons and like how they're like influenced maybe by like cartoon art.
Tex Avery, Chuck Jones type stuff, right?
Yeah, or even like political cartoons.
Oh, yeah. I was saying that it looks like political cartoons.
Yeah.
It feels like you could do one of those, you know, those posters that have like all the Looney Tunes on it.
Yeah.
Like you could definitely do that with the Coen brothers. It's world building through characters with their own little nuances.
Their costume designer often talks about like when she designs the costume, she's trying to change the outline, the silhouette of the actor. You know, she's like, John Turturro has shoulders, but I can make his shoulders look like anything. So he's a different shape than the actor he's standing next to, using hair the same way. Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, you could definitely see it on this amazing, the costume that George Clooney has, like the way that this like V shape, you know, like creates this like, you know, hourglass kind of like shape. It's like very, do we ever see him without the costume in this movie? I don't think we do. I think he's wearing it the entire time.
Naturally.
I have a question about when the guy's Marcuse, John Bluthal, is talking about the man is unitary, a simple economic agent. Man's institutions are split, expressing contradictions that must be worked through. This is just basically saying that like every contradiction that's inside like a human soul is like represented out in the open in society. So it's just going to play out.
Well, it's interesting that there's a scene earlier in the movie where he meets the with the faith leaders and they say man is split.
Right.
So there's like different ways. There's like the sort of communists who are probably atheists or, you know, at least stereotypically, they say man split. And then the faith leaders say that God is split and, you know, God and man are kind of related. So I guess we're all trying to like find like we're all trying to like find some kind of holistic integration of ourselves and society or something. I don't know.
What are they trying to make the audience feel or go through by having these characters drop that suitcase in the end?
Well, they
like, they're up to something here. There's a mystery of like, what are these guys plotting? At the end, it's like to get Channing Tatum on that submarine and to give him all the money that they've saved up. And then it falls in the water.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's trying to say that they were, I think the Coens are kind of trying to say that they're like rubes a little bit, that they sort of fell for, or they sort of all scammed themselves.
I don't feel like the movies are supposed to be that judgmental though, yeah. To be like, this person's stupid or this person's right. There's something. Is it just the disappointment of it is what you're supposed to feel?
Well,
or you think you're supposed to feel superior to them at the end when they drop that?
Well, one thing that I was thinking about is just that, like, you know, Channing Tatum is like hardcore getting like run out of town for being gay and like basically had an affair with his like director, like a director that like Eddie Mannix kind of like foisted Hobie Doyle onto like earlier in the movie. And so like, I don't know. I think it's just interesting that like in the 50s, like they sort of make the character who like escapes on the submarine and like becomes a communist, like is like this person who's like sort of a person who's like an outcast from society. And it's not easy to be gay and outed in the Hollywood press
in the 50s
and a communist.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think there's a lot of compassion there as well, basically.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say.
Does anyone else have any thoughts about the scene in Hail Caesar?
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mike.
I think relating it back to the dog sled scene, it seems inevitable that things are going to fall apart, that we're going to argue, that people on the same side are going to find reason to disagree. And so I see kind of this scene as kind of an example, kind of maybe relating back to the White Sea, in that it's just not going to work out. It's always just never going to work out. And I'm, from my experience with Coen Brothers movies, it just never works out. And like that maybe is the interesting thing about this flashback, is that maybe we'll see that Muldrow kind of understands that it just doesn't work out in the future. And that's the thing to be aware of, that like people are going to fight, dogs are going to fight, and as we'll see in later scenes, you know, what you think is going to happen is just not going to work out right. And so,
yeah.
These guys are talking about knowing the future, being able to scientifically predict it. And that just makes you feel like there's no way that they're accurate about that.
Yeah. They probably can't see the future, but like I said, the left has always been like, you know, I think outside this, you know, the movie itself might be reactionary. And so I think it's important just to like have a reality check that like, you know, left-wing organizing in Hollywood is like actually seen many great improvements to the lives of workers.
The briefcase doesn't always fall in the ocean.
No.
Yeah. It doesn't always bounce off the submarine and fall in the ocean.
Yeah.
Do you think part of that through line of like things not working out in pretty much all these movies is like, could there be a subtext there of like, even though these things aren't working out, you know, you have to try, basically. I mean, you know, it's like
absolutely.
There's every one of these characters in this scene, you know, Hail Caesar, like is like a different strategy, a different I don't know, face of the prism, if you will.
Yeah.
Of like this plot. I'm thinking particularly of like, I think I'm thinking of like A Serious Man or something. But like there's yeah, it's like no matter what strategy you try, they all eventually come together in the end. And it's almost like this is very esoteric, but like, you know, we go through life, we split up into these different, our lives take different channels, blah, blah. And then in the end, it all just wraps up. It all just ends, basically.
Yeah.
That's always the vibe I get. There's something very like kind of morbid about Coen Brothers movies, but it's an enjoyable ride at the same time.
I think that's okay. But here's the thing. He has this political awakening, and by the end of it, he can really speak on it, like to Mannix. He can really talk about how everything that they're doing in Capitol Pictures is basically just bread and circuses to entertain the masses while like workers get exploited. And then Eddie Mannix kind of like slaps him and like bringing like fear of God back to him. And then he goes out there and gives a beautiful performance, like a movie star worthy performance in this like sort of silly, hokey, but also kind of like beautiful classical Hollywood epic. And I just want to say that like that's the dialectic, right? Like there's synthesis, there's antithesis, and then there's the what's comes after that? Analysis, yeah.
Thank you, but
and that's what happens in when he's making that speech, right? Like that's the Hegelian synthesis.
I don't know anything about this stuff. It's all brand new to me.
Oh, thesis, antithesis. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis?
Yep, that's it.
Yeah.
You got it.
So the synthesis is his final performance, I think, at the end of the movie. And so it's not all just unraveling. Like there is like in this movie at least, and I think like that's kind of what makes it like their most optimistic movie, maybe, is that like it does actually lead to a point, which is like making this movie that I guess entertains people and connects them to God and the God in movie making and in movies.
I think creativity is a source of one of the only things that work out in Coen Brothers films. At the end of Fargo, you know, every character's endeavor has absolutely gone to shit, but her husband has painted a lovely bird, which is on a stamp. Pretty cool. Like, and they can sit in bed and like enjoy that together, that he created something and now it's going to be on a stamp. And whenever people, you know, when they update the stamps, you need the little stamp and you put it on and it will be there and people will be able to, you know, not only mail their letters, but appreciate the aesthetics there. Or like Julianne Moore creates a life in Big Lebowski. When you have an ambition that's doable, which is to paint a picture or make a baby, you know, these are doable. These are doable things. Whereas if you're beautiful. Trying to, you know, get your wife kidnapped because you're too afraid to ask your father-in-law for money, that's the kind of thing where, you know, man is brutally punished.
I think that's beautiful, John. Really, that's great. I never connected it to the stamp, but like, it's seriously no. It's another great example of like, you know, achievable goals. You know,
I think you know a lot of what they do draws on film noir, and a lot of the theories around film noir is that it was all about in the 40s and the 50s. There's a lot of conformity. There's people who've bought into the normal rhythms of work, community, corporations, employment. And you have people like Marge, and that's just like working for them. They're doing great. Their allegiances keep their life stable. And then you have film noir characters who sort of set out on their own. They sever their ties to marriage and community, and they go after some crazy goal, and their life unravels as a result. Like every noir movie is main character's life going to crap.
Right.
And I think what's cool about some of their films is they have both. And you don't really see that in a classic noir. Like in Fargo, you see the stable community and the value of that and the rewards Marge gets from that. And then you see also the noir guys whose life just falls to sorry, right. You can cut that.
No, that's good. Should we move on to the next clip? And we'll synthesize that. So this scene from Oh Brother. This is a scene where the trio, the Soggy Bottom Boys, Delmar, Everett,
Nelson is the bank.
George Nelson is babyface Nelson. Babyface Nelson, they've sort of joined his criminal enterprise, and they enter the bank, and they pull off this bank heist with him relatively easily, I would say. And then someone under their breath says, calls him Babyface Nelson, and he gets really mad. And then,
what's Tim Blake Nelson's character's name?
Delmar.
Yeah. Delmar puts his hands on Babyface Nelson's shoulders to kind of calm him down. And then in the next scene, you see he's kind of crashing from his manic episode, and he like gives them the money and kind of wanders off. and John Turturro's character like stuffs all the bills into a bag. One of the things I just wanted to say about this scene is like, this is very different from how a heist scene usually goes in a movie. It's much more character based. Like, it's really more about like what the characters are going through. Like, that's kind of the joke of it, right? Like, the mechanics of the bank heist are like not really in play. The closest they come to that is George Clooney being like, "You got a plan to get us out of here?" And he's like, "Yeah, sure." And then basically he's shooting a gun in the air, asks for a bag of money, gets it immediately, and tosses it to his friend, and tosses it to George Clooney. And then they have this whole thing about Babyface Nelson and how he doesn't want to be called Babyface Nelson. And so it's like, that's the joke of it, but I also think it's like, you know, it's more unexpected. Like, we, you know, and then like in Buster Scruggs, they did like the bank robbery scene kind of more for real with Stephen Root and whatever his name is. Yeah, I don't know. I just think like the teamwork in this scene is really interesting to me. And I chose it because, you know, I think it's really easy to like see Tim Blake Nelson's character Delmar as sort of like a throwaway or like sort of just like a side character. But watching it again recently, I realized how important he is to the story because he's so gentle and he's so like able to empathize with like anything. Like, he's like not the livestock. He loves the toad. He's got like butterflies on his face, like before he gets beat up by John Goodman. And then in this scene, like, he really defuses it like expertly, like without even thinking about it. He just puts his hands on the guy's shoulders. I don't know. I just like, oh, and also this when he, after they steal the pie from the windowsill, he like leaves a dollar under a rock, right? Like, that's his character. It's like, he's not just like a fool. He's actually like a real peacemaker and like a just a gentle man. And all the characters have their own things. Like, I guess George Clooney's thing is just being like super rational and a fast talker, can kind of talk his way out of anything, but is always thinking and always scheming. And then I think Turturro is just sort of pure greed, right? Like, pure avarice.
I think they're actually like, well, they could be like the reptile brain, the mammal brain, and like the Homo sapien brain.
Yeah. Right? Or the id, the ego, and the superego.
Something like that. Yeah. Seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. They're the triad for sure. Also, when they go into the movie theater, it's a scene from a movie from like the 30s. No, it couldn't be the 30s, right? Because this takes place in like 1900, right? Anyway, it's just a scene of a woman like sort of doing this weird little flip. But that's actually a scene. That's actually a movie that has the Three Stooges in it. So I think it's just that.
This takes place during the Great Depression.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. So, I don't know why I thought it was earlier. But anyway, I think that's like a pretty obvious tell in terms of like where their heads are at, that they chose a movie where the Three Stooges are in. I think this is like, this is the Odyssey starring the Three Stooges, basically.
Yeah. That's very, very locked in. Does anyone have any reactions to this sequence? Anything that jumps out about teamwork? What is the team exactly as you see it?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about this movie is that the team expands and contracts over the course of the movie. Like, so some scenes they've got there with Tommy Johnson and they record that awesome song together. Then some scenes there with Babyface Nelson, they join up with him. They got the kid who kind of drives them around for a little bit and like helps them escape. So the team's always shifting because they're always like, the dynamics are changing.
Is that a picaresque?
I would say this is a picaresque for sure.
What defines a picaresque exactly?
A very episodic story about characters kind of wandering around, and each scene kind of has its own vibe and they sort of maybe learn about society, but in kind of like a variety plate type of way.
They're good. They always run the risk of getting a little laggy, like towards the middle, right?
Yeah.
Because by its nature, it's just like you build up a character and then you just drop them. And I mean, do all these characters come back? Is there like a payoff, or do some of these characters just, they leave and they never come back?
Towards the end of this movie, after they come out of the, after they get pardoned and they did their sort of triumphant song on the radio and they're like, they're their identities are revealed, and like Charles Durning, Papio Daniel realizes that he can kind of use their popularity to propel his own campaign. And like the radio as like this liberalizing force. They come outside and they see Babyface Nelson's about to like get taken to the electric chair, and he's very excited about this. So like he's having this manic episode again, but this time he's excited that he's gotten caught.
He wants to die. I mean, the thing with he has all the, are those real bombs you think he has attached to himself?
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. No, he says, do you have a plan? And then you see he opens up his, forgot to describe this, but he opens up his jacket and he's got a bunch of dynamite in his jacket. But I don't know why I and the characters, I think both, like as a viewer, I don't think you're actually worried about him blowing himself up. Are you when you watch the movie?
Definitely. I'm super worried about it. Absolutely. It's chilling.
How does everybody else feel when you see the like suicide vest? Does that make you worried?
He doesn't seem to have enough resolve, in my opinion, when I watch him to do it, go through with it personally.
Okay.
Well, that's good to hear because, I mean, maybe it's just because I've seen the movie so many times over the years that like that didn't like really, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm actually going to jump in here too.
Please do, yeah.
I feel like a normal and sane, if you're completely sane, you're not strapping yourself with bombs. So it's not like, he may not be completely, he may not have the full resolve to go with it, but like, there's something going on there as well.
He seems dangerous to be around.
I love, my favorite is just when he shoots that gun in the air, just like as emotional, it's so sad at the end, the last time he shoots.
It's just one shot.
It's just one shot.
Yeah, there's something about having a machine gun that shoots off one shot.
That's not in the script. I think this is a classic thing where it's like, what actors are able to add in Coen Brothers movies is like, I'm sure he just like...
He plussed it.
He punctuated that and they were like, that's really funny. And the timing of it is really just how short it is.
Yeah.
Really defeated.
I've been thinking about that. When you guys said that on whatever episode about actors kind of finding their own thing with physical stuff. I think that's such a good point when I watch now. With Hail Caesar, I was going to say Clooney's sitting there with a finger sandwich in each hand.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, I don't know if that was him, but it's just like there is so much to the actor's physical. It was just a good point you guys made.
He's having fun with his finger sandwiches for sure.
Well, it's just good too because it's like they're throwing all these different ideas at him that are kind of contradictory. They're kind of arguing as they're trying to read him in at the same time. So he's got a sandwich in one hand. He's got a sandwich the other.
He's looking from one to the other.
It's just like he's getting overloaded with stuff and he can't pick anything else up. It's just really fucking funny.
Let's switch gears to Llewyn Davis.
Yeah.
So this is a scene, kind of an oddball choice for I will say that about myself. You know, there's another scene that's great in terms of like forming teams, kind of characters kind of like coming together and we'll have to do this at some point. Have to figure out a way to do this. Is the scene where they record "Please, Mr. Kennedy" together? Just the way that especially because that is recorded live. Just the way that you see them come together is an amazing another example of teamwork. But I didn't want to just like choose a musical performance. It didn't seem like it was as interesting or as like relevant. And so like this sequence is. It's basically when the valet, Johnny Five, is that what he calls himself? Johnny Five starts to talk for the first time. This character is like the most like stoic, recalcitrant guy. You know, he seems chill, but he also just not, you know, man a few words. And then suddenly you realize that he's an actor and a poet. He starts describing how he was on a show called The Brig. He's basically saying to Llewyn, like, you know, I'm an artist. I acted in this and then the cops shut it down. And then in the next scene, and Llewyn says, "Oh, why did it?" He says, "Like, why did it end?" And then he says, "Cops shut it down. It's a long story." And then we see in the next scene, he's reading poetry, kind of like beat poetry, I would say. And John Goodman's character goes, "Yes," just like vibing out so hard, and he's like, "I got to go to the bathroom and do a bunch of heroin, or whatever he's doing," and then. Llewyn goes up to the counter. He says, "How far away is Chicago?" That's the one time we kind of get a sense of like what his plan is. And then, we get a sense that he might be planning something. And then he goes into the bathroom and he looks at the wall, and there's like a little piece of graffiti. I'm going to just skip that ahead because I want to remember exactly what it says.
It says, "What are you doing?"
Oh, it says, "What are you doing?" Yeah. And then he hears something going on in the next hall, and he sees John Goodman is like passed out, overdosing on whatever opiate is he's doing. I want to guess that he's... You think it's heroin?
Yeah, the strap around his arm.
Yeah, well, okay, so what I was actually thinking is morphine, just because, like, I don't know, because it makes me think of, like, Ed Wood. Like,
that's what I was thinking of, too.
Yeah.
Bela Lugosi and Ed Wood has, like, the same tube.
Yeah.
Or Martin Landau. Yeah.
But pretty much the same thing in terms of, like, the effects. If anybody knows the difference between morphine and
DM Jordan.
DM me. Yeah. DM me the Wikipedia.
Asking for a friend.
yeah, exactly. I think this is a really interesting sequence because it's like this is a movie about someone who does not connect that well with people so easily, but he's connecting with Johnny Five in some way. And then Johnny Five is connecting with John Goodman too, through his poetry. And then they connect together to hoist this guy up and help him get out of there. Help him get into the car. And something about when he's falling asleep, I know it's sort of supposed to be a little bit like feel a little detached and disconnected, but I think it feels a little comfortable too. I think he feels at that moment that maybe he's like can just relax a little bit in a way that he hasn't in other scenes on the road.
I mean, these guys are all artists.
Yeah,
they're,
exactly.
They're three artists. There's a jazz musician. There's a beat experimental avant-garde actor, and there's a folk singer. And they're all three raw dudes. Like there's other points in this. Like you think about like when he's recording with Adam Driver and Justin Timberlake. They're just softer. They're just like more plastic.
Yeah.
Or they're able to exist in that world more easily, where he's very uncomfortable. Where it's like all this kind of like being in the car, just being kind of lost. Like he kind of feels at home with these guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I just wanted to say at the end of this is that the tapping on the window at the end is the cops basically ruining that sort of triad that they built, which I think is so interesting because, you know, at the beginning of the scene, Johnny Five says the cops shut it down. And then that's exactly what happens. In the end of this sequence,
John Goodman is so mean to Lewin in the scene. I guess before this,
yeah,
when
just
on their
right
way,
before it, yeah,
just ripping into him and saying the thing about who jumps off a bridge, talking about his partner,
yeah,
his partner who committed suicide, and that he's so brutal in that scene, and I feel like Lewin is really kind of pissed. It's interesting. I agree with what you're saying that he seems kind of at peace in the next scene in the car after this, almost like he's taken kind of pity on this guy after helping drag him. He's like, okay, I'll cut this guy some slack because he's like, it's just a mess.
He realizes like he's a morphine addict, you know, he's disabled.
All those people, all Lewin's friends back in New York are relatively like decent, cheery, well-off people.
Right.
And he's always disappointing them.
Yeah.
And even though they like him and want to be his friend, it's really an especially bleak thing to realize with this, that like he's hanging out with these like demons and he's like, well, I guess I'm like, these are maybe my people after all or something, like, and then I guess, yeah, they get arrested and he has to, or whatever happens. Yeah. He moves on. But I've always just thought he's pretty unhappy when he's with these people. And it's funny in a sad, really sad way to realize he's actually considering that maybe he's more at home.
Yeah, he's connecting a little bit.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
It's like, yeah, because it's the moment where he's like, we got to call the cops. Like, this is, it's beyond Lewin's line, you know? And Johnny Five is like, this is fine.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in control. I'll take care of him. We got the cat in the car. We got Lewin in the car.
Yeah.
We're all driving in the rain together.
Yeah. He's all right.
We're all right.
Let's jump ahead. I feel good about that.
I feel good about that too.
Yeah. Okay. So next up, I wanted to
say about this quick scene, this first scene I chose from True Grit, I just wanted to give some crucial context, which is that like Matt Damon has just like viciously spanked and beaten Hailee Steinfeld like right before this scene. It's like when she looks super stoic and upset, that's because she's like, you know, been treated really, really badly by this guy.
But he starts to hit her, and then Jeff Bridges pulls a gun on him because she's paying for both of them to be there, and that's his loyalty is to his boss.
Yeah, and so like I chose this scene as a preamble just because I think it's really important. And this is when they're sitting around by the fire, and he says like, you know, in Texas I do it differently. I build a smaller fire. Then they have the argument about like whether he drinks out of hoof prints and whether his like horse is lame. Like the horse looks like a sheep, and they're fighting, and then Maddie kind of diffuses things by saying, "Let's do the gentleman caller, and I'll tell you, you know, I'll do all the voices, and or I'll play the caller, and I'll tell you guys what to say." But I just wanted to basically say that like these scenes are, hi, no, come sit, join. No, if you want to, yeah. Basically like. I just wanted to choose this scene because I think this scene is a template for every scene of these three characters throughout the entire movie, except for the scene that I chose after it. These characters are fighting and at odds with each other throughout the entire film. Like usually you'd have a movie where, oh, like, you know, by like the middle of the movie, oh, they're starting to get along. And then like by like the third act, they're like a cohesive unit and they all go up against like, you know, some larger adversary. There's definitely the scene where like we finally get to see Matt Damon use that carbine gun, and he picks off one of the guys, and that's a huge help for sure. And it definitely makes a difference in terms of like Jeff Bridges' character making it. Them kind of forming a team actually really happens more off screen when like they decide to, when he says like, I saw a beef down there, like I decided to come back for you and all that. Like, that's like all action that happened not on screen in this movie. Scene after this where he's going to rescue Maddie out of the snake pit. And then you see them kind of working together. And the big thing for me is just like how Matt Damon built this whole like contraption of like pulleys to kind of, to use the horse to pull them out, you know, like a pulley system around a tree with the horse pulling Jeff Bridges up. For me, it's like, that's the moment where we have the teamwork, and it happens at the very, very, very end of the movie. It's like the last thing. I don't know. Like, isn't that interesting that this movie is so, holds back so much, but then when you see it, it's so satisfying.
I think a lot of the times these characters are kind of doing their own thing and just kind of overlapping each other. And that's how they get out of situations. It's like they go, you know, it's like, it's never like one complete motion. It's like she gets kidnapped. She's in trouble. They go after him. Like Jeff Bridges does something cool, but then he needs Matt Damon to pop out. Like everyone keeps popping out of nowhere to save each other because they're not really like working together. They're kind of just like all three of them are running around being very stubborn.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and the moment where you would think, the moment in the story that you would think they would start coming together is like after LaBeouf comes back and they have that shootout and he basically saved LaBeouf's life. But they're just so ornery because LaBeouf bit its tongue halfway off. And for some reason, Rooster just starts drinking, just binge drinking.
Yeah.
And so he's in no state to like form a coalition. I don't know. I think that that was like the thing that interested me most about this movie, watching it again. It's just like, you know, just how dysfunctional the relationship is until the very end when, you know, when Maddie's life is really, really threatened.
What I like about the campfire scene is they really are competing for their boss, and they even call it out at that point. It's like, you're trying to make me look stupid in front of her. You're trying to make me look stupid in front of her. And at the end, she's like not interested at all. She's actually a kid.
Yeah.
Like that. And that's like the whole dynamic is like all three of them are not out there because they have to. They're chasing someone who's not, like, there's no threat to any of the three of them. They're all on a mission to find someone and kill him.
Yeah.
And it's because she wants them to do it, and everyone else is like, this is not totally necessary.
Yeah. What else did I have to say about this scene?
Well, what about when he sucks the venom out of her?
Yeah, I mean, that's good stuff, but that almost relates more to like the next scene to me.
Like, well, for sure.
I don't know, like the venom, like I guess it's like a big scene that you would see in a movie, right? Like, you know, like it's very, it feels very like.
You've seen it in other stuff.
I've seen that in other movies. Like him
it's
sucking
more just,
up the
band. It's like the completeness of the way he cuts it.
Yeah, in an X.
The music cue that starts when he does it. Yeah. The way that he's so, he's not kind in a lot of other parts of this movie, but he is kind in that moment.
Yeah, well, he's cutting her arm, her hand. So like,
yeah.
Yeah. Oh, something I wanted to say about this is like a random thing, but isn't it interesting that like the snakes inside the dead body, to me is so similar to the frog inside of John Turturro's clothes that he left behind that formed the beating heart. I don't know. I just was like, to me, that was just such interesting, kind of like parallel imagery.
I think there's a cool dynamic in this scene. It reminds me of Barton Fink, of kind of like the pedantic, nerdy, spectrum-y guy that likes to hold forth about the one thing that he does. And then the working class, slightly overweight guy who just sort of totally. Gets stuff done, and how they're in opposition. And I feel like the Coen brothers...
Say it on mic.
It's not that important, but why would they overdo these symbols? Like, you know, they could say somebody, a leg in a movie means, the underpinning of the united grandness of, anyway, that's all I have to say.
Right on.
No, yeah. I mean, I think that they would agree with you. I think that they don't, I don't think the Coens want you to, like, be like, this symbolizes this, or, like, get too intellectual with it, you know? Like, I think we're probably overdoing it. But like in general, like I think they just want you to have like fun with the story.
I went to Barton Fink.
Oh, really? Did you saw it in theaters? Mm-hmm. Oh, cool. That's awesome. What's your favorite Coen Brothers movie? They did Barton Fink, Big Lebowski, Blood Simple. So many greats. You think Barton Fink's your favorite one, maybe? Or no? No. You don't like that movie? No.
I did think it was a very fitting punishment for a pedant, which is what Matt Damon is, to lose part of his tongue. Yeah. Sort of like punishment for talking too much in an annoying way, like cosmic justice or whatever.
He did it. He did it to himself, though, you know? Like, he bit his own tongue, right? I guess he was under duress, though.
He's got those sad looks on his face. In that campfire scene, there's a couple times where he's like... You put on a show for Maddie with what you must think is a keen tongue. He really looks sad, you know? He has this wounded look on his face that he deploys at two moments in the scene. Also, when he says, when Rooster says, I think she has got you pretty well figured, the look on his face in the fires, he's really torn open by it.
Well, I think that, like, Matt, that's probably, like, why Matt Damon is, like, so perfect for this role is because, like, he kind of has two personas, and like the best directors will figure out a way to blend it. You know, like he's got like the action hero, Jason Bourne, or like the totally slick, like talented Mr. Ripley. But there's something about him that's like wounded or vulnerable or like not fully there. Like,
well, my problem was that I could not believe that he could be the talented Miss Ripley, because for some reason I would never have... I don't know if it's the director or the script or whether it matters or not, but I was fascinated how these other people did not understand that he was a complete whatever.
You didn't think he was charming enough to like get by? No.
Somehow I didn't really think it. So that's the problem with the movies, is that you look at it from your own point of view.
Yeah. Is it based on a true story? No, it's a novel, right?
I think it's based off of a novel, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw that movie like maybe 4 months ago. That's wild.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
It's a vibey movie.
It's a very vibey movie.
I like Philip Seymour Hoffman in that movie.
Do you like the actor or the movie? Or...
Well, I like Matt Damon a lot, but I think I'm more interested in just like how he, in terms of movie stars, most movie stars do not make themselves so kind of unlikable as Matt Damon. Am I wrong about this?
I don't know. I mean, He's such a huge movie star. He's like McDonald's, but I do like his.
Oh, you hate him.
I don't hate him, but I like his performance in Beyond the Candelabra a lot. I think that's probably my favorite thing he's ever done.
I really like him in Downsizing, too.
Yeah.
So you do like him?
Yeah. I like him, yeah.
He's both clinical, but also like innocent in that boyish way. Yeah. And it's just one or the other. Yeah.
I feel like LaBeouf is this guy who like and Matt Damon does. I think they, like you're saying, it's a good use of Matt Damon. He's this guy who has never been challenged back in Texas. He's a Texas Ranger, but he's not in Texas. Right. And you see him kind of realize that it's a whole different territory. He's not in his country, and you realize that you see Rooster and the girl. Him realize that they think he's stupid. Like they'll say something and he's like, they'll be talking about like something a dumb guy might do. And he's got, you see on his face and being like, Oh God, they're talking about me. Oh, they don't think I'm that smart.
Great in The Informant too. I feel like,
yeah.
Also
kind of in the Ocean's movies, he's kind of this dumb guy that they kind of corral into these circumstances where he's great at what he does.
Yeah, he has virtuosity in that, or you could say Goodwill Hunting, but also really vulnerable and clearly someone who was in his own head for most of his characters and sort of gets in his own way. And that Goodwill Hunting character, the part he wrote for himself, is a guy who, it's a 2-hour movie where really he just needed to learn to be like, if I like a girl and I want her to be my girlfriend and she likes me, I should spend time with her and be nice to her and we'll be happy together. And I should get a great job that I'm being offered. I should take it. You know, like I think it sort of sets the stage for all the Damon roles where he's incredibly good at something, and I guess LaBeouf is just articulate and like a, you know, basically handy, you know, certainly better at Texas bushcraft than I would do.
Yeah, but he also got seriously bushwhacked. Like he walked into that thing and he got, I mean, he would have been dead if Rooster hadn't been up on that cliff.
He certainly seems a bit like a bit of a fool, despite being competent.
But John, you're saying he's like an idiot savant, kind of like he's. Or sorry, go ahead.
But would you be able to believe that he was really evil? Like he was just like cool.
Has Matt Damon totally ever played a fully evil guy in a movie?
Ripley's pretty evil.
I really like this idea that he's a savant in every role he's in. And down to the Bourne movies where he doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know who he is. So yeah, he's this he's an idiot savant in every role.
Kind of a digression, but could I just add that Mike White's inspiration for Chuck and Buck was him seeing
Goodwill Hunting.
Goodwill Hunting and being like, it just pisses me off that these guys wrote a movie where he gets to be the smartest guy ever. And so I'm going to write a movie where I'm going to be like the most unlikable, like, you know, developmentally disabled, like stunted childhood character, like unlikable.
Pardon me, but in that movie, he really was kind of evil because he said, I know I'm smarter than you.
In Ripley?
No, Goodwill Hunting.
On some the level, true
he
evil.
Was kind of nasty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bully.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe he's a secret villain of that movie.
Seriously.
Wow.
But we like seeing, that's a cruel, a lot of movies are cruel, and that movie's cruel. You like seeing that shitty ponytail guy who is being mean to Ben Affleck. You like seeing him humiliated by a monologue in which Matt Damon has somehow memorized, like, at least 4 books down to the down to like what page in the index, which is just not how memory works. We've all met smart people, and they don't talk that way. They don't, like, memorize every word down to the index number, but you enjoy seeing him torture this guy. And of course, how do you like them apples is obviously a exuberant moment.
So maybe the rest of his career is his atonement. You know, he doesn't.
What was your question just there? Sorry. Oh, did you give John drugs? Those
drugs.
I've been asking myself that for years.
Let's move on to the next clip. Or did
you want to throw in a final thought? You feel good?
I would just say, yeah. I mean, I think as a final thought, this is the first time that we've had a scene that leads directly into another episode. So if you want to listen back to episode 7, we'll go, you know, you'll kind of be able to see how this sort of triumphant formation of the triad leads into an amazing fever dream action scene where Maddie and Rooster gallop. You know, to try to save her.
Yeah, where it becomes a 3-person scene between Maddie, Rooster, and Dreams.
Yeah, and the horse.
And the horse, yeah, for sure the horse. Maybe more That's more solid.
All right. Well, okay. So next up is this little scene. Oh, actually, this comes right after the scene that we talked about where Steve Buscemi, another bridge to a previous episode where Buscemi just had a single pin and left up, and then he found himself a shadow across the came across his face. Then Turturro walks over to them, Jesus, and he says, you know, what's this day of rest shit? Well, we'll mess you up on another day. And then they go outside and they tango with the nihilists. I think this is an interesting scene just because Walter really takes charge, and for a character who's messed things up. Well, I guess no. He definitely no. I take that back, because they had a chance to get off easy by just giving them like $17 or whatever. And Walter's like, "No, this aggression will not stand." Again, have you ever seen an action scene like this before? Like, it's like not how a one normally functions, because usually you know, it's three against three. You see like one guy punching the other guy, and then you see somebody punch somebody else, and then you see the third guy, and you see all their different fighting styles. And in this scene, you know, Walter is just dominating. He like throws his bowling ball at the guy, and then like he bites the other guy's ear off, which is horrible. Was this before the Tyson thing?
I believe it was after Reservoir Dogs, but before the Tyson thing.
Yeah. Interesting. And then he hits the guy over the head with his toolbox. Is it a toolbox? Well, what is it he hits?
A bowling bag.
It feels like it's a toolbox. I don't know why.
There's a head inside the bowling bag.
No, I think that's Barton Fink.
It might be the Nihilist boombox.
Yeah, it's the Nihilist boombox. Okay, so then we know what that is. And then, so he's a kind of a MacGyver in his own way. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the end of the scene, we see that
it's supposed to be confusing, yeah, isn't it?
Totally. No, this is a movie is like it's just throwing curveballs at you the whole time. I mean, it's like it's a confusing, stoned Raymond Chandler detective movie. And then at the end of the movie, at the end of the scene, we see that Donnie had a heart attack, which is very sad. And we have that like the fade out, and we see the stars isolated against black. This is the most literal version of teams in this movie, and we don't end the movie with a big bowling competition, but we do see you know, first they kind of face off against Torturo in terms of conversation, and then they face off against a 3-on-3, the trio versus the nihilists, and then we have a fight scene. So how does the teamwork happen in this scene?
Well, absolutely. I mean, to me, I've seen this movie so many times, but I had never noticed how funny Totoro's sidekick is. His performance is amazing. The arc of it, the beats that he's playing as he's like worried about Totoro, then he starts to feel good, then he starts to kind of laugh at them.
Yeah.
I think it's so fucking funny.
He puts his hands up. Yeah.
Yeah.
I never even noticed that.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Look at him on the. Okay, we
he's
just
really
slow
supportive.
It down. Just look at his face, worried. Then he's starting to feel a little more confident. Now he's smiling. Now he's laughing. It's great.
Yeah.
That guy's killing it.
Does not have any lines in the movie.
No lines.
Yeah.
But just like also like, so, you know, talk about like someone just like with a gray face that just like tells a story, just, yeah, you know, his body language and his face. Guy's just perfect balance to Totoro's performance.
He's really Totoro's Donnie, you know?
Yeah.
It's a mirror right
now. For sure.
Right. Okay, we're talking about the dog.
It's pathetic that he's just going along with it. Okay, now this makes sense.
Yeah, well, he's fully riding. This guy's having this wild, like, manic outburst, and he's really tethered into it, being like, okay, dad, like, where are we going next? Okay, well, yeah, I love my dad. You know, it's like that. Yeah.
There is something pathetic about it, for sure. Like,
yeah.
No. So, yeah, I mean, like, so it's basically two, like, really heated confrontations, and we kind of get to see how these characters operate. And I think, and for me, like, it's like, you know, with the way that, like, things went with, like, the handoff earlier, you kind of expected it to go a lot worse, I think.
Both times the issue is that, like, John Goodman is, they meet two different groups of people. They're like, hey, that guy in your team is violent and crazy.
Yeah.
Right? Because he won't back down. Like, they could get out of the situation. He just won't let that become just a simple mugging that costs them less than like $30 or something. Yeah. Right? And then
yeah. certainly he escalated the situation.
He wants to go towards violence all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Goodman has a lot of the classic symptoms of PTSD as a Vietnam vet, you know, sort of like he's stuck in a state of crisis. And so he'll escalate a normal situation into a crisis.
Yeah.
But I think this scene is cool because like a lot of people with PTSD, when an actual crisis occurs, he's pretty useful suddenly, you know, paradoxically. Instead of creating one, he like fixes it.
Although Donnie probably would not have had that heart attack. Maybe he would have had it a week later.
The dude's philosophy would have, in retrospect, been better here to try to buy off the nihilists instead of engaging in hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, it seems like Walter has finally had a situation where he's useful, but then you kind of realize that he actually is the reason that it turned violent anyway.
Yeah.
But I think that made me realize the through line to these clips that I want to point out, which is just I think that you have these characters who are pretty unsuited to their environment pretty much at all times. Walter is never, you know, okay where he is. Llewyn Davis is always a downer. He's killing the mood. LaBeef, I guess, is kind of like overthinking things and kind of like he's kind of like the man with a plan, but no one really needs that. And then in these moments that you've chosen, their dispositions towards the world have become useful in some way to the people around them.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Babyface Nelson as well, another fragile macho man who, you know, is getting in his own way. You don't have to rob banks and get electrocuted. That's no way to live. You know, you should live a normal life.
Well, if you really were going to go through with it, you don't want somebody hanging around with you who's going to say, wait a minute, think about this.
True, yeah. I mean, Django doesn't surround himself with other people like him. Whereas Jesus has a guy who is right on the same page as him.
Yeah.
They
seem
like they're happier.
Yeah. But I mean, happy, so to speak. You know what I mean? Like, Jesus is making all sorts of bad choices. His friend is probably enabling him. I think that's it. I mean, okay, so like, I think in all of these scenes, at the end of it, they're closer together, right? The characters have aligned in some way. I think that's interesting.
How does that work in O Brother? They're supportive of their friend, even though he's going through some bad stuff.
Yeah, they're kind of together at the end, you know? They're kind of coming to an understanding. Although I guess, you know, their friend wandered off, but they seem like they're in a good place.
They still love him. He just has to go work some stuff out.
And they kind of had a windfall, too. You know, like they got a ton of money out of
it. They get a lot of cash.
I think maybe slight story flaw is like, why are they still stealing cars and like being bad? Like, don't you think like they like, after they have that much money, like, don't you think they could just like, you know,
just drive there?
Like live a little bit more legitimately.
I'd like to say something about another movie. I was watching this movie about the basketball guys, and I forget all the names of the characters, but they kept on betting against each other and playing basketball in Brooklyn. And I left the theater with a guy who came from Pakistan. And he was a little older than me. And I'm walking out of the movie, and I'm saying, I don't really get it. Like, why is that all that interesting? And he said, because they risked everything over a basketball game.
Which movie was that? Do you remember what it was called? Who was in it?
I think Woody Harrelson.
Oh, yeah.
White Men Can't Jump.
No.
That was it.
White Men Can't Jump? Oh, really? Oh.
Woody Harrelson's getting his own.
No, but he was in a movie. He was also in a basketball movie where he's coaching the like developmentally disabled. It was just in theaters.
But my point is that some of these set up situations that I can't identify with. These people want to risk their lives for something that doesn't make. I mean, I guess it's sort of interesting. Like, how would you be put to it or something, right?
How would you react? Yeah.
Right. So I never got involved with a crime scheme.
You sure?
Like, they have heist movies.
Yeah.
Right. And they put people under strange situations. But what you're saying is that they made some of these people look good and some of them look worse.
Mm.
But they're all stuck in some kind of situation that they never had to be in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, some people are along for the ride, for sure. Oftentimes, I mean, I think that's always the danger of, like, joining a team, right? Is that you're, you know, you feel good, you made friends, but then also you're kind of giving your ego. You're, like, have you dissolved your ego, or have you just sort of joined this, like, larger ego?
That no, has they its still own? Have egos.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Oftentimes, the characters in Coen Brothers movies will do these things because just out of a sense of pride or to... They have this kind of classically literary, like, single reason for hubris. Doing the thing they're doing. Yeah, hubris, whatever. Yeah, like a kind of flaw in that way.
Remember in Reservoir Dogs, where the guy says, "I don't want to be called purple. I want to be called tan or yellow or whatever."
Yeah, like, for sure.
All of a sudden, I don't know if that relates to this movie, but do you remember what?
Well, it's Steve Buscemi, right?
What a bizarre thing to say. Yeah. Like,
but it's interesting because the crime boss says, "No, we don't let anybody choose their own colors anymore because everybody always wants to be Mr. Black. So this way, we just give people their colors, and that's the color they have to stick with." And that has to do a lot with building a team.
We're all the same.
Yeah, we all have to
follow
the
same rules.
It has to be, some of this has to be arbitrary in order to make the rules of the team have to be arbitrary and just, like, you know, in order to, like, you know, make this function.
HR says you're Mr. Pink.
Exactly.
And that's
yeah.
it. You don't get to decide.
You need an HR department when you're forming a heist team or a criminal enterprise. Should we play Joel or Ethan and then
yeah, does anyone just have any other, I mean, I feel like does anyone have any closing, like, tie this all together kind of stuff?
Can I note one thing that's
for
driving
sure.
me crazy? So in the To the White Sea script, he fights with dogs, a lone man in the wilderness, as the sun is going down at an artificially fast rate. And then a few years later in No Country for Old Men, Josh Brolin fights with a dog in the wilderness as the sun is coming up artificially fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels like such a clear, we didn't get to make this, so we're going to make it again.
Yeah.
I had too much coffee and I rewrote the same scene. Didn't really realize it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, especially because that stuff is not, I mean, I don't know, you're reading the book
fun,
right
now.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, they did it because it was
It's
fun.
An awesome scene. It's
they
very memorable. It he has to dry out the gun and swim through the river and then put it together and the dog jumps.
It's a fever dream action sequence. See episode 7. oh, can we talk about, okay, just one thing, and we'll, like, do this for like 60 seconds because we've kept there. But so you were saying that the dog stuff in the study group was different? I wanted to just follow up on that.
Yeah, I think it seemed more different when we first watched it and I was following it along, but it's just like in the script, the dog is, like, really making a ruckus when he walks in. Is the be quiet Ingalls line even in the scene?
I don't think so.
Get the dog's name?
That dog is passed out.
Yeah. So, and it sounds like they just planned on working with a livelier animal.
That would have been good setup, but I didn't need it either.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I didn't miss it, but
cool.
I have a thing, Jordan.
Yeah.
Okay. So everyone talks all these different ways. They have really different, they represent where they come from and their point of view.
Yeah.
They're talking past each other crazy. Often these sequences, it's physical touch. It's some kind of physical interaction that is the bonding thing, whether someone's passed out, ODing, someone needs to get dragged out of a hole. Someone just needs a hand put on them.
Yeah.
You know, it's often just like, everyone just, like, talk so hard at each other.
Yeah.
And then it's like, ultimately, it's like, we're still here together. And I'm going to help you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. I like that. Should we play Joel or Ethan?
Yeah. Let's play Joel or Ethan, and let's do it in a kind of competitive. I think we have enough for, like, do four people want to play it? Who wants to play Joel or Ethan? Okay. Do you want to run Joel or Ethan?
Pretend you're a
Coen
brother.
Basically, do you want to do it? Okay, here. I have a book.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple. How many people actually want to play? Is everybody? I think we could have everybody play.
Everyone do it?
You could hold up your left hand if you think it's Joel. Hold up your right hand if you think it's Ethan.
You want to do competitive?
Yeah,
or you
want
to do everyone together?
Everyone.
I was thinking we would.
Like, could you give us, like, a cheat sheet of, like, What are they supposed to, how are they supposed to be different?
I mean, I don't know. I can't give you anything. Ray thinks he's doing good.
Yeah, I got it figured out.
Okay. Cool. Yeah.
All right, well, let's just, we'll
so,
go ahead and
so basically, Austin, what you do is just open up, find a quote that's either attributed to them, just read the quote, and then we'll guess whether it's Joel or Ethan. Yeah. And I guess the last person standing is the winner.
It's the winner.
That's
the,
pretty exciting rules, Jordan.
Yeah.
Ooh, this is good. Okay. Quote, it's almost like a genre rule. Don't open the box. Joel or Ethan?
Which one's, which hand is which?
Left is Joel, right is Ethan.
Don't open the box. Answer now. Give the answer. The answer is Joel. Wow, he eliminated. Wait, did we eliminate everyone?
Hello.
Who survived?
We have a winner.
We have an instant winner.
We have an instant winner.
What's your name? What's your name?
I can't tell you.
Okay.
Okay. Well, you smoke. You smoked the entire room. We all said Joel. We were all.
No, I said Ethan.
I said Ethan. Ethan. We all said Ethan. Okay. Can we just talk about why did we all think that that was?
I don't have a rational answer.
What's your theory of the difference between the two of them right now? Does anyone have a theory of the difference between the two of them? Character-wise?
I thought it was because Ethan split off and just wrote books, and that seemed like a very writerly quote.
Okay. So he's a man of words, whereas Joel is a man of action.
Yeah, I think it's because it was talking about plot dynamics. Just I think of him as the writer, and it was Joel.
Okay.
All right. Well, so the elimination round is done. We have a winner already.
Wow. Do you want to
just do a few more?
Let's do one more to see if we can get one with a little bit more attention. But
there you go.
That was great.
It was pretty good.
Searching. Here we go.
Ray, don't look.
Oh, okay,
I'm looking.
Okay.
Ray's peeking.
Okay, here we go. Yeah, that's what T-Bone likes to say. They're both verbal traditions, oral traditions.
Uh-oh. Okay.
The answer is Joel, yes.
Okay, we're all right.
I'm guessing T-Bone is Ethan's nickname. Is that?
No, T-Bone Burnett.
What is, okay.
T-Bone. Who got eliminated in that round? Okay, you're right.
I think I still understand which one's which.
We could. I don't think we could do a limit because we already. I mean,
we've already
crowned a winner. Yeah.
I thought we were going for a second round that wasn't just a complete knockout punch. Yeah, you knock out like eight people in one punch.
Yeah, I don't know.
Could you tell me which one is which visually? Like
the tall one
is Joel
with the fingerless gloves is Joel. The one's just a slightly shorter and a little more academic, a little more soulful. Not soulful,
both
but
wear glasses.
One's a sweetheart.
I feel like I see Ethan wearing glasses.
They both wear glasses. What do you got, Austin?
Okay, here we go. We wanted to create a mystery around the character who was going to become the movie's hero.
Right hand is Ethan.
The answer is Ethan.
I'm out.
Three for three. Thank you. Three for three. Thank you to our anonymous guest.
You're right from your left.
I don't know my Joel from my Ethan.
Well, thank you all for coming.
Yeah, thank you guys.
It's been amazing. Yeah. Thanks for sticking around. And that was To the White Sea, episode 10.
Pages 19 and 20.
Woo.
Come back next week for pages 21 and 22.
Yeah, and don't come back here because we're not going to have a live show next week. But come back on your podcast app. And thank you all so much for joining us for this experimental.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I really, for the rest of my life, I will always be grateful for you guys to come to this recording. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. You're officially cool if you came to this.
Right on.
Have a good night.
To the White Sea is produced by Jordan Fish and Ray Tintori.
Starring Griffin Newman as Lieutenant Muldrow.
Production support provided by Ben Hosley and Ike Sreeskandaraja.
To the White Sea theme music written and performed by Dan Romer.